Welcome to STEAM Powered, where I have conversations with women in STEAM to learn a little bit about what they do and who they are. I'm your host, Michelle Ong. My guest today is Dr. Blake Chapman. Blake is a science communicator who loves all things marine, especially sharks. She has a PhD in shark neuroscience and development and is passionate about communicating about shark behaviors and the myths and misconceptions around shark attacks. Join us as we talk about sharks, shark attacks, and Blake's enthusiasm for science communication. Welcome, Blake. Thank you so much for joining me today on STEAM Powered. It's wonderful to speak to you today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited about the chat.
Yeah, me too. Like, there's just so much to cover. Hopefully, you know, we get to talk about all these really cool things. So what drew you to the field of marine biology to begin with?
Well, yeah, I've always just really had a passion for the water. I've loved the water. So I was a swimmer when I grew up. So, you know, I didn't care if it was a pool, if it was a lake, if it was the ocean. I just loved being in the water and I felt really comfortable in the water. But then I also just did develop this really, really big pull to the ocean. So my family used to go to the beach every year for holidays. So the ocean has quite a sentimental meaning to me because that was our family time. It was the time, the 1 week of the year where we'd all come together and, you know, my dad would forget about work for a while and we'd just hang out as a family. And I loved it. And then, you know, as I got older, it started to have even more meaning to me because I was starting to realize that this was just this big, wild place out there. And there's just so many things that I couldn't understand. And I'm a very curious person. So it just intrigued me. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand more about what lived there, how it worked. And so, yeah, I guess my passion just developed from there. And then I started watching a documentary on sharks. I won't name any names about what that might have been. And my curiosity started to just sort of tug on me a little bit. And I realized, you know, we don't know a lot about these animals. And a lot of the things that we hear, I'm not sure that it's actually true. And so it just inspired me to really want to understand these animals more, to just learn about them, to know what we were thinking about, know what we were hearing. And the more I learned, the more I realized most of the stuff that we're hearing isn't actually true. And so then that drove me to want to talk to people and want to communicate and start to rectify some of these misunderstandings.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. So when you started to, you know, when you wanted to study marine biology, where did you see yourself afterwards? Was it always going to be about the communication for shark protection, or, you know, did you see yourself doing other things with it?
I wish that I could say I had a plan. unfortunately, I wasn't such a good planner when I was younger. I knew that I loved sharks. I knew that I loved the ocean. And I knew that I wanted to do something. that was sort of the extent of my planning at that stage. So when I went into undergraduate university, I did have this passion for sharks. And so I went into biology. I did my undergraduate degree in America, where I was born and where I grew up. And degrees are very different there to what they are here in Australia. It's very general. So biology was only about a third of the degree that I did. But I also had to do a lot of just general studies and then also some of the core subjects. I still did English. I still did, you know, pretty much everything you can think of. I took a dance class. I got my scuba diving certification while I was doing my undergraduate studies. So it was just very broad. But then I started to focus down. And again, my core through all of this was that I wanted to study sharks. So once I finished my undergraduate degree, it was then that I moved to Australia. And again, the drive was sharks. And I just happened to get into a neuroscience laboratory. And so that was my introduction to neuroscience. And I studied shark vision. And that, again, led me to just really want to be more hands-on. So I had a little bit of experience working with the sharks. But my next step was I wanted to go out and be a bit more hands-on. So I then went into industry. And I worked at a public aquarium. So my path has been a little bit, it's never really been directed in a single way. It was more collecting these experiences that for some time, it did make my life a little bit challenging in that I didn't have that clear path. But now, looking back on it, the different opportunities that it's opened up to me and the different experiences that I've had have just been amazing. And
Exactly.
for a while, I thought, oh, I wish I had done this differently. But being where I am now, I'm so glad that I did what I did.
Yeah, well, all the experiences that you've had just kind of lead you towards that focus. So, without that, you would have been somewhere else entirely.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So, why specifically the shark neuroscience for your PhD? Like, it's, I mean, I understand, like, because it's misconceptions, you want to understand, you want to be able to delve into it. But, is it a common sort of a research area for sharks?
A little bit. So sharks can be, in some circumstances, very large, very powerful animals. They don't easily lend themselves to being kept in captivity. So for many terrestrial animals, we can either study them in lab settings or we can keep them in zoos or wildlife reserves where we have reasonable access to them and where we can follow them around. Our studies of marine animals doesn't necessarily work that way. So yeah, there's over 500 different species of sharks. So one of the things that I try to drive into any conversation that I have is there is no typical shark. That is a huge myth. You have every different shape, size, body plan, color of sharks imaginable. But when I talk about sharks, mostly I'm talking about the ones that people are concerned about. And so for human interest, you can't keep great white sharks in an aquarium. You can't keep tiger sharks for too long. Some places have kept them for a little while, but they get very big. They need to move around. So it actually does come down to a lot of things that we can infer about these animals. And one way that we can infer some things is through sensory biology. So for my honors and PhD, I was looking at how sharks' eyes developed. I was in an evolutionary lab, so sharks being a very ancient lineage of animals, pretty much one of the oldest vertebrates that we have alive on this planet now, that was where they sort of fit into the lab group. But we were looking at how their eyes developed and how they are able to fit into their ecosystems and function in their environments through their sensory biology. So what can they see? How do they focus? So, do they tend to stay on the bottom and then come up as they're looking for food? Or so, where do they have their best sensory capabilities? And it just helps us to understand the nature of these animals and what they're capable of doing. One of the things that we were looking at was color vision. So that, of course, has, there's a idea in the field about yum yum yellow. I don't know if you've heard about that.
No, I haven't. Tell me.
But it's quite an old concept that came about through the US military. And they were finding that people who were wearing these bright yellow life vests were more of a focus of attention of sharks. But we have found that sharks don't really have color vision in the sense that we think of it. They can still see different brightness and different intensity. So there's that, slight discrepancy between colors, but in the way that we think of color vision, we don't believe that sharks are actually capable of that. So it's not an uncommon thing for certain animals, and different marine animals have gained that ability and lost it. So very closely related stingrays, for example, do have color vision. But those are some of the things that, we're making these inferences and assumptions based on what we can see through studying their eyes, for example, as a proxy for understanding the animals as a whole.
That's very interesting. Like I actually heard the yum yum yellow thing, but forgot about it just because it just yeah. But yeah, it reminded me of quite a few years ago, people or I think a bunch of surfers or something had come up with shark camo wetsuits. So was that? Do you know about that stuff?
I do. So that was developed by some of the researchers who I used to work with.
Yeah. Cool.
And I guess there's been a couple of different iterations of this. But it's all about trying to understand again how these animals see and how they perceive other things in their world. So there's a lot of things around color and patterns in nature, not just sharks. But if you can mimic something that is a threat to the animals, then they're more likely to stay away from it. With sharks, that idea is, I'm not quite sure that I follow that one, because there's not too many things out there that threaten sharks. And that being said, there are some mitigation techniques that revolve on orca calls. So if they can mirror the call of an orca, because we do know that they are actually natural predators of great white sharks. So things like that. But as far as the visual side of things, you know, some of the wetsuits that I've seen are banded like sea snakes, and sea snakes are a preferred food item for tiger sharks. So some of the things, I'm not too sure that that would work. But then some of the camo wetsuits, they were really specifically designed around some of the different functionalities of shark vision. So how they are able to see things, how they're able to see patterns, and how they're able or unable to discriminate between slight differences in color. So the whole idea was to break apart a silhouette, because again, there's this idea that misidentification, I suppose. So if you look at a surfer laying on a surfboard with their arms flapping over the side and their legs, then there was this idea that they might look a bit like a seal or even a sea turtle from a silhouette. So if the shark is swimming along the bottom and they're just getting this outline, then there could be room for misidentification there.
Yeah.
That theory is I can't prove it wrong, and I don't think anyone can really prove it wrong. It's an idea, but most sharks have pretty good eyesight. So I think that there would be some differentiation there. But the idea of the sweatsuit was to break up that silhouette so that sharks wouldn't really even be seeing a silhouette so much. So the concept is really sound, I think. The problem in those sorts of things lies in the fact that there are so many different species of sharks, and they rely on their different sensory systems differently. So what one might see, another one might not be seeing the same thing. So with any sort of protective device against sharks, you have to be very careful to understand the exact species that are going to be where you are. And in some cases, there could be multiple ones. So you do have to kind of have that in the back of your mind if you're relying on these different mitigation measures.
Yeah, but you know, all very interesting and novel ways of trying to approach the problem. Just yeah,
very cool. And I love it. I love the creativity around some of these things, because we don't know. And yeah, people often ask me about different strategies, and I think, well, you've got to try. You know, so many of them are bound to fail, but until you try, you don't really know what's going to work or not. And
yeah,
I think it's always a really good strategy to be creative and to just see what comes out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just so many different things, you know, because we don't know. As you said, it's all inference. So you don't know until you try it out.
That's right. And we still don't know. I mean, there's so much that we're still learning about how these animals are sensing their environment and what's motivating them.
How is research being conducted to try and kind of figure out these little details that we still don't know?
With a lot of complexity. So there are the different sensory studies, and to an extent we can use different bits of tissue, so different bits of the animal, which in some cases unfortunately means that we have to kill the animals first, which is something that's not obviously a good thing, and we try to avoid that as much as possible. So to do that, we might then use smaller species of sharks. So for my PhD, I used quite a small shark. But then again, we're having to assume that what is happening with that one animal is going to be happening more broadly. Otherwise, we are starting to get better at tracking sharks, and through our different monitoring strategies. So there's all different tags now that can record either external tags or internal tags that can record where a shark has been, where it's going, the temperature range, when it's eating, how quickly it's swimming, which informs what its motivations in those areas might be. So the technology, I mean, it's all going to come down to just better and better technology, and you know, more just getting out there and studying them. So it is quite an exciting space, but it's very time consuming. Like, none of these things are going to happen overnight, because
you
know, it is hard to first find these animals and then to take the time to track them. And for a lot of our larger, more mobile species, they're using different parts of the environment, different parts of the world, really, at different times of the year. And males might be using it differently to females. Juveniles are using it differently to adults. So building this really big picture is just such a long-term project.
Yeah, the scope is just phenomenal. Like I was talking to Janine Illion, who does a lot of statistical modeling, and she does it in terms of ecology. And she, some of the stuff that she did talk about was about the difficulty of modeling all of these behaviors and kind of factors that you need to consider when you're doing marine animals, just because of ocean. Yeah.
It just adds this whole level of complexity that I think, so many people want answers right now, which I understand, because there is this fear of sharks, but unfortunately it's just not something that you can do. You can't just keep these animals in one space and continue to monitor them. You have to let them do their thing. That's what we have to start to understand.
How do you do your independent research? Do you have to be tied to an institution, or how do you work with other people to get this kind of stuff as an independent?
So I'm not affiliated with any institutions. I have had different positions along the way, which have all been hugely beneficial for my learning and my experience. But at the moment, I wrote a book first, and it was all just research on my own time, and it was a hugely rewarding thing. But that did open the door to talking to the public, which is really something that I never got out of any of my university positions, and it's something that has taught me so much in terms of just communication. For a long time I was so reliant on numbers and statistics, and you talk to people and you say, oh well, statistically speaking, this happens, or you're one in this however number, likely to do this, and people just don't respond to that. And I sort of wish I had known this before I wrote the book. Just since having all these new opportunities to talk to the public and to talk to kids and to sort of have these debates with people, I've just really learned a lot about how to better talk to people. So I'm just sort of snowballing that and taking every bit that I learn with me and going out and trying to do a bit more and more.
It's amazing.
But I just go out and just try to talk to people. So the research that I do now is it's not so much research anymore. It's more of a communications thing. And when I do, I stay up to date on all the publications. I get Google alerts for all the shark research papers that come out, and I just keep reading those. But it's just all in my own time.
Wow.
And all the things that I want to be engaged with and keeping abreast with all the new knowledge, and using that to then go out and talk to people.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, just being able to keep up with all of it and being able to communicate with the entire community who are researching sharks, absolutely wonderful. So we understand that there's a lot of misconceptions out there about sharks and shark behavior. So what motivated you to write a book as opposed to, approaching the communication of this information in other ways?
Well, I guess at the time when I wrote the book, research was what I knew. It was how I had been trained, and it was really what I had done up until then. But I wasn't then affiliated with the university, and I wasn't really able to conduct research in the ways that we traditionally think about research. So I then just, thought about what I wanted to know. And I knew that there was a bigger picture than what we were seeing. Research is great, but it's slow, as we've talked about. It takes a long time. So by the time that you're really trying to answer a question, and then you go out and you do the research, you validate your findings, you do the statistics, you write the paper, and then the paper goes through the review, it's a really long process.
It is.
So writing the book, I was able to take the research that I knew, first off. So I started with the statistics because that was what I knew. But then I didn't want to just do the statistics. I wanted to really inform the community. And to do that, I thought, okay, well, what else is there? What other pieces to the puzzle are there? And so I did my little biology chapter talking about, the biology and the physiology of sharks because I felt that that was important background reading. I knew that, most of my readers wouldn't be interested in that, but I also felt that there was a need to have that to support arguments that I made down the track. And then I also thought, okay, well, again, what are people going to be interested in? They're going to be interested on how to prevent these things. So I did a lot of research then into the different mitigation or prevention strategies that are used around the world. So Australia is a bit of a hotspot for shark bites. It's very
Yes.
topical here. We do have some, but we're not alone. There are a few other places in the world. So I was looking at what they were doing. So I looked at the legislation as well. Some people actually
Yes.
try to, or some regions try to legislate against things that could lead to shark bites. And I think our understanding is that that doesn't overly work well. People don't like to be told what to do, especially when you're talking about surfers or people who go out and use the water. That's a mindset. So telling people that they can't do that doesn't work too well. But then, I was actually really curious about why people are so afraid. These things happen so rarely, and I knew that in my head. But I also, even through doing my research on neuroscience or whatever it might be, when I told people I studied sharks, you could just see the fear. And I've had people tell me
But
that they don't go in
why?
their home swimming pool at night because they're scared of sharks. What? So I really wanted to understand the fear around it. Why we do fear these animals so much when the numbers are so low and when most people haven't even seen a shark or don't live anywhere near the ocean and still they're scared of them. So I did a bit of background research into psychology and I talked to researchers in the field and I talked to clinical psychologists because that's certainly not my background, but I found it absolutely fascinating. So I looked into that and then the big turning point for me and what really changed how I saw things and how I started to talk to people in subsequent strategies was that I really put myself out of my comfort zone and started talking to people who had had these experiences. Because for all I want to say towards the line of thinking that these are extremely rare events and statistically almost negligible chance of having them happen, sometimes they do. And when they do, they can be extremely traumatic. And they don't just affect a person. If the statistics, that's something the statistics don't show. It's not one person for every bite. It's the first responders. It's the people, the doctors and the paramedics and the community, the family, the friends. So these are things that you don't get until you actually bring the human side into it.
Exactly.
And as much as I would like to remove that to help people understand how small of a risk it is, you just can't. It's something that has to be addressed.
Yes,
So,
you can't divorce yourself from the full impact of the event
yeah.
just because, you've got the numbers there.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll never be able to have an argument or discussion with someone if you can't accept that people have emotions and this is how we learn. We learn through storytelling. So everyone's heard about these things and it is a factor if, when we talk about shark bites. So I like I said, I put myself out there and I just started basically cold calling or reaching out to people to see if they would be interested in sharing their stories with me. I had no experience in journalism or I had no idea really how to do this. And the first couple of people that I talked to, I was terrified. I was, on the phone talking to them and I was shaking. I was so scared. And, these are very personal, very emotional experiences that I was
They
talking
are.
about. And I had a bit of imposter syndrome. I was like, I don't have the skills and the understanding
I'm
to be
just
able
a
to talk to
researcher.
people. Exactly. But the people that I spoke to were so wonderful, so lovely, and so brave to share their stories with me. And I think that I learned a lot from them and I was very open with them and I just tried to convey that I'm just trying to help. I'm trying to help people to understand what you might have been through. And yes, I'm going to be bringing the science into it, but I also want to bring the experience side in. And I made some really amazing connections through doing that,
Yeah.
and it's just absolutely changed the way that I think about the situation and these events and how I've gone on to communicate with people.
Yeah, that's amazing because, you're looking not just only at the psychological and behavioral factors around, sharks from the shark's perspective, but you're also getting, the other side as well, getting the human connection, the way that we relate and interact with all of these things. It's, yeah, there's a lot to it.
That's right.
What changed the most for you after speaking to these people about their experiences?
I think just really understanding the situation more broadly. Like I said, I'd been used to looking at stats, and I just couldn't understand why there was so much fear and why we were making so many decisions in terms of, setting shark nets and drum lines and things like that when so few people were actually being bitten. But yeah, just talking to people, I really started to grasp that there is just fear, and that's not something that is their fault. It's a very human thing, and people are different. How we respond to these things is different. Everyone has a different background, and it's not just shark bites. It's any sort of trauma, any sort of emotional experiences. And it really helped me to understand that everyone is different, and it's not anything like there's no judging a person and their beliefs, because you don't know what they've been through. You don't know what they've experienced and why they're forming these beliefs. So it really just taught me to talk to people and to ask them questions to help them, to tell me their story, and then I can start to talk to them, because until I understand where they're coming from, I can't then try to help them to understand the situation a bit more realistically and move forward.
It's a very
So,
holistic way of approaching it.
yeah, and it's amazing. Like it's really just opened my eyes to a bit of human nature, and again, just how to better talk to people, which has been it's been a really fascinating journey, to be honest.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the only kind of exposure that we have, if we haven't had direct contact with sharks, is through the media. And, what we're seeing is the events that occurred and they get reported to death and they talk about the dangers of sharks. But how do we move forward from the fact that this is the kind of fear that w that's being projected on us, and how do we kind of move on from there to trying to get a bit better understanding? We're not getting rid of the fear, but how do we work better with sharks?
But this is it's something that I have thought about, and again, it's sort of informed what I do now. So in studying the fear of predators is a very primal fear. It's our the way that we assess fear is based on how it's helped us to survive, really. So fear is essential to humans still being in existence today.
Survival instinct, we need that.
That's right. And so our very earliest ancestors learned to fear predators. They learned to fear things like open spaces and also confined spaces. So those are very primal fears. They're extremely easy to learn. And like I said, humans are storytellers. So for these really primal fears, all we need is a story. That's why, Jaws had such a major influence on how people view sharks, because we were seeing it. We were seeing these things happen. And that's all this very deep-seated fear of predators needs in our brain to take hold. So it's a very easily learned fear, and it's one that's extremely hard to get rid of once we have it. But the way that we can deal with these sorts of fears is to sort of beat them to the punch. So if we can almost immunize ourselves against these things, then we have a much better chance of not acquiring the fears if we do hear these stories later on. So I really try to focus on talking to kids now. I love going out there, and if I'm very honest, one of my fears was children for a long time. They just ask these raw questions, and there's no filter, and so I was very intimidated for a while. But now it's become one of my favorite things, going out and talking to kids about sharks. But what I try to do when I do that is give them a very fun, very engaging session where we just talk about sharks and we talk about all the cool things that they do, and we just have a good time with it. So anything that gives you either positive or even neutral experiences with something that could later cause a fear, when you do have that exposure, you're far more likely to be buffered from it because you think, oh no, wait, I'm hearing this, but actually I know that, there's all these cool things as well. Sharks
You have
are
all
really
this
important to
background
the
information,
environment. And so, like I said, I try to go to schools, I try to talk to kids, I do sessions through libraries and things like that. But I also really try to get people to go out there and go to aquariums. I'm a huge advocate for aquariums. So just seeing these animals and seeing a very realistic impression of what they do, they're not out there just eating everything in sight. They're not, swimming through the tank and there's just, like scales and blood in the water because they've eaten all their
Debris.
teeth. It's not how they work. They are doing their thing and coexisting with all the other members of their enclosures. And so just having these experiences, if you're a bit older, a bit more adventurous, you can go out and go snorkeling or go diving and see sharks in the wild. And the adrenaline that you get from doing that, and they're just these really amazing experiences. So anything that you can do to give yourself positive or neutral experiences before you might be exposed to the news or stories or things like that is really the best way to tackle some of these fears.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, you have to start with education. So with your work consulting and speaking to other people about management strategies and mitigation strategies, I mean, it's one thing to be able to try and inoculate through teaching kids, but how do you approach doing that with adults who've already had that kind of fear instilled?
Yeah, it's a lot more difficult because they do have these preconceptions. They might have heard about things through the news or through friends, and people tend to associate themselves with people who have the same views, and that just reinforces those views. So in some cases, it's almost impossible to get a message across to people because they are very much, they know what they know, and no matter what you say to them, you're not going to get through. And that's okay. But for people who are a bit more on the fence, or who are maybe undecided or a bit more willing to reason, then you can start to talk about why they might be afraid or what their views are on shark nets. Why do you think that shark nets are a good thing? And then they might say, oh, because I want to be protected when I go to the beach. And without trying to scare people, you can say, well, actually, sharks can swim around shark nets, they can swim under them, they can swim over them, and yet they're attracting all this bycatch. So many animals are being killed by these shark nets for this what's a bit of a false sense of security. And then you can sort of start to have the conversation, and with whatever they come back with, you use different tools in the toolbox, I suppose, to try to address what their thinking is. And so it's just information, but it's information based on what they want to know. I'm not just throwing facts. For a while, that was my approach. This is what I know. I'm going to throw all these facts at you. And I would be talking to a room of people who are just, you could see them sort of, wandering off or going, no, that's not what I think. And so, I've really learned to ask questions first and to let people tell me what they believe, because everyone is entitled to their own opinion. And like I said,
Exactly.
you don't know why they formed that opinion. They might have had an experience that I wouldn't have thought. So it really just does have to be a conversation. And I have to, you have to be on the top of your game. You do have to have all these different tools in your toolbox, because you never know what they're going to come out with. But it's a puzzle, and it's just a conversation, and I try to keep things lighthearted. I don't need to push my views onto anybody. That's not what I try to do. I just try to have the conversation.
Definitely. So, as part of that conversation, when people are talking about regional management strategies, I guess because it is so difficult to change minds once people have set in their ideas, a lot of these strategies tend to look like physical barriers or, just actual tactile ways of being able to approach it. But have you come away from any of these consultations, or have you encountered other people who have tried other novel approaches to trying to handle this?
Yeah, there's a lot of work being done in this area. Our very traditional methods have been shark nets or mesh nets or gill nets, whatever terminology is going around, which are these, you know, finite expanses of net that are designed to catch sharks that might be coming into the beach. And then drum lines, which are baited hooks that are anchored to the bottom and they've got to float to the top so the sharks come in. So it's basically a passive fishing method. Both of these methods have been designed to kill the animals, and they can kill a lot of other animals as well. And we know that they do. But we have things now that are called smart drum lines. So this was sort of one of the first really technical developments on these very traditional things. They've got something that as soon as there's a certain amount of pressure put on the drum line, on the hook, then they basically text whoever is on call. So this was developed in Reunion Island, which is another one of those, you know, global hotspots for shark bites. And what it does is it allows people to have a lot more choice in what happens to the animals. So as soon as someone gets this text message, you have someone on call and they can go out straight away. So in New South Wales, for example, the contractor who's responsible has, I think, half an hour to respond. So it's very quick. Almost as soon as something is caught, someone is out there. And usually the contractors choose to stay out there and just go fishing or have a day on the water. So it is often a very quick response. And most animals can survive that amount of time on the hook. And so they can be pulled in and released. And it even gives these people the option for sharks that might be targeted. So, you know, great white sharks, tiger sharks, which are normally killed if they're caught on these things, they might choose to instead tag them and release them. And then we get this information. We can see where they're going. Are they
That's
going
awesome.
Out to sea, or are they coming back into shore where we don't really want them? And so we're then learning. So we're using these things to learn and answer the questions that we need answers to know how to better remove the risk or minimize the risk. You'll never remove it. So that's a really good strategy. Other things, drones are excellent. You know, people, it again comes down to how people think about things. You know, a lot of people out there, they like shark nets because they know that they're there and they feel safe. So it's just
a physical
that feeling.
Kind of safety blanket. Yeah.
Yeah. If you tell them that they're not protected, that these nets don't actually prevent sharks from coming in, then they're shocked. They feel like these are impenetrable barriers that a shark can't get through. So yeah, coming back to the drones, you can hear a drone, and it's the same for helicopters and planes. So surveillance, having any sort of monitoring, whether it's human or whether it's unmanned, it's a very visual signal to people that makes them feel safe or allows them to feel safe. And then they can go out there and do their activity with, you know, whether they work or not. And this is the thing with any sort of mitigation, whether they work or not, the risk is so low that if people are out there and able to focus on something other than, you know, constantly looking behind them to see if Jaws is coming, then it's a win because people are out there doing what they want to be doing. They feel safe, they're enjoying themselves, and the risk is so low. If these things then do add that advanced level of security, then it's almost a bonus. But you know, the technology is getting so good with drones. We can have a program course for them. So they go up and down. In some places, again, like Reunion Island, they have multiple drones sitting there. So one will run its course, come back, and then while that drone is recharging, then they send another one up. So it's almost,
That's
in
cool.
some areas, almost constant surveillance.
Wow.
And then there's all these different software packages, technologies that allow them basically, you know, you don't even have to be watching them. We're starting to be able to recognize swimming patterns and discriminate. The key is to be able to discriminate between clouds or dolphins or other things, a log that might be swimming in the water, and sharks. So we're understanding, you know, how sharks move and being able to model that. And, you know, feed all these algorithms that I don't know anything about into these systems that, you know, can say, okay, you know, there's a shark there and no one has ever had to even look at it. The drones are doing their thing. These different programs are doing their thing, but yet all of a sudden we're getting an alert. There's a shark there. You know, let's pull people out of the water.
Oh, wow. Just the machine learning, all the imaging tech that's required for that. That's awesome. Gonna have to look into that.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. So Reunion Island's employing all the different strategies together at the same time.
Yeah, that's it. I mean,
That's
there is no
nuts.
silver bullet. There's nothing that is going to reduce this risk to zero. That will never happen. Sharks are wild animals. They are unpredictable.
They're going to do
Their
what they're going to do.
Motivations are unpredictable. That's it. And, more people are killed or bitten or injured by their household dog. And, again, I don't tend to rely on the statistics too much. But we have to understand that even domesticated animals have the potential to leech out, to lash out if something goes wrong, if they feel threatened, if they, are, whatever the case may be, if they're injured, wild animals are going to do the same. So no matter what we do, we are not going to reduce this risk to zero. But the more things that we're using, the more different strategies we're employing, if we've got lifeguards on the beach, if we've got drones going back and forth, if we have people who are educating themselves and knowing the risks and reducing their likelihood of being in an environment where a shark might be quite active, all these things are going to just continue to lessen the risk. We've got acoustic tags and trackers that are out there, and only a small percentage of our sharks are tagged, so they're not seeing everything, but we're understanding their movement better. And so we might know at this time of the year, sharks are more likely to be in this area because they're mating, or because juveniles are coming out of the river systems and going into the big bad world, or we're starting to understand how they're using the environments a bit better. So all of this coming together is really the future of non-lethal, better protection strategies that are going to allow us to coexist.
Yeah, cool. So going to segue for a little bit. I was told that you co-hosted an event where you invited KISS to perform for sharks. So how did that brilliant idea come about?
I can't claim the idea. And I have to say, when I was contacted about it, I honestly thought that it was a hoax. And I've got a colleague who actually didn't respond to the email because he thought it was a hoax. So it was just this wild and wacky idea. So it was Airbnb who were launching their experiences, their animal experiences arm of their business. And what they've gone down the path of is providing excellent animal experiences that are sustainable, that they've got this huge long list of requirements that the experiences have to tick off before they're willing to back them. So they can't have any major impacts on the environment. They can't be likely to change animal behavior. So it's a really good way of looking at it. And I think a lot of it's kind of setting the trend for the industry. But they wanted to make a big deal about this launch of the experiences. And someone must have thought, what's the biggest impact we can have? And so there's a company in South Australia that does cage diving for white sharks near the Neptune Islands. And there's actually three companies that do that. The other two use bait and they chum the water to lure the sharks in. This company couldn't get a license to do that, it turns out. And so they had to think of something clever and creative, and they tried music. And so what they do is they play music through speakers under the water. And we know that sharks are attracted to different types of, obviously different species respond differently, but some sharks are attracted to these low frequency pulse noises, which can be boats, but they thought, we're going to try music. And they found that they were getting the sharks to come in with music. It's one of these eco-friendly tourism companies. And so Airbnb found them and they thought, they use music. Who is the biggest, baddest, loudest group that we could get? And they contracted KISS to come out and do a live performance on a boat that they then projected into the water off the Neptune Islands to just celebrate this launch of their experiences. And it was as crazy as it sounds. it was eight people. So eight people were awarded tickets. So it was a very intimate show. KISS was on a boat that was tethered to the one that we were on. There were far more cameras and cameramen and staff than there were guests. but I was invited to come along to be the one to talk to the guests about sharks and to provide any sort of education around these animals. So it wasn't just about the music, it was also about the sharks and the environment, and yeah, just how people could learn more about them and use this as an experience to move forward.
Yeah, it's such a great idea. So I saw that no sharks ended up turning up, which was disappointing. So had they used KISS before for their luring?
They had played KISS before, and there was some opinion that the sharks might not prefer KISS. But, you know, it's actually really funny. I got to know this tour operator a little bit and had some conversations with him. And it's funny because, you know, different sharks, according to him, have
different
preferences for artists and for songs. And apparently they hate Baby Shark.
Well, that's fair.
You know, everyone, all the guests always wanted them to play Baby Shark, thinking it'd be amazing. And, you know, I don't know if it was a strategy just, you know, to protect the staff from having to listen to Baby Shark over and over again. But apparently sharks don't like Baby Sharks. But, you know, they said that there was one song that they would play, and reliably every time that they played that song, the same shark would come and circle around the boat. And then
Aww.
When the song finished, the shark would swim away. And,
that's
you know, again,
cool.
it's very seasonal. Sharks are seasonal in the Neptune Islands. They come and go at different times, and there's almost always sharks there, but different individuals utilize the area at different times, different seasons, and different ways. So, yeah, I mean, that same shark isn't always going to come back, but for, I think it was like a 2-week period. Yeah, reliably when they played the song, the shark would come around.
It's a fantastic area to research if someone was so interested.
Yeah, I have lots of questions, and I was really... I was really doubtful, to be honest, when I first heard about it. But, you know, like I said, I'm not there to prove anyone or to discourage or anything like that. And, yeah, they have great stories. So I went out a couple times, and I was a bit unfortunate. I didn't get to see any when I was out there. But, yeah, they've got a great track record of seeing sharks. And it's actually I sort of like the fact that they don't always get sharks to the area, because it does feed into that eco-friendly tourism operation avenue. If they were conditioning the sharks to come around and to always be there reliably, then that is changing the shark's behavior. It's encouraging them to stay in a place where, as naturally, they might be needing to spread out to do other things. So the fact that they aren't always there, I think, is a good thing. The fact that they do come in and that they are able to show people sharks a lot of the time is a great thing. So I was just unfortunate that I didn't get to see any, but
yeah, but it's definitely
still
a great way of
fantastic.
Doing it.
Yeah, it really was.
Awesome. So your passion for sharks led to writing Shark Attacks. What prompted you to write the new book that came out this year, Ocean Animals?
Well, this came from just that desire, like I said, to be talking to kids, to be engaging with kids. Yeah, like I said before, we can go to zoos and get these experiences with terrestrial animals. It's quite easy. We have birds. We have all different animals in our backyards. The closer we look, the more we're going to find. And so it's easy to engage with these animals, to appreciate them, to learn about them, to know that they're there. That's not the case for our marine animals. We can't just go out and observe fish. You know, some of us are fortunate enough to be able to go diving, but, you know, there's age limits on being able to dive, and even scuba or even snorkel, you know, you have to have the skills and the confidence to be able to do that well. It can be very tricky to pick up for people.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, these great aquariums around the world, around the country, but it's a small part of what the oceans really hold. So really, I wanted to give kids a way to experience some of these animals. And I know it's just through text, but I tried to paint some really good imagery and to get some really quirky stories in there. You know,
yeah,
I wanted to have a mix of animals that kids would know. You know, there's dolphins and whales and turtles, but also some animals that I had never even heard about. So I'd be pretty well guaranteed that the kids who are reading these books had never heard of them either. And there are some crazy animals out there. And
There
the more
are.
research I did, I fell in love with this marine world all over again. And yeah, it's just intriguing. So I really wanted to have some hooks in there that through my words and through the pictures that, I had colleagues who provided some absolutely amazing photographs. There's some great illustrations in there, and I just wanted to hook the kids a little bit, to give them that little incentive to go out there and either watch some videos online of these animals or to think about them a bit more critically if they had a school project to do, to go out and talk to their family or friends and give them a reason to start to think about the marine world in different ways. And if opportunities came up for them to be thinking about, school projects or whatever, and to just give them that bit of a drive to learn more in whatever ways they could, whether it's just reading about it or whether they, grab their parents, pack up the car and go to the beach for a day and take some photos or, splash in the waves, whatever it might be, but just, to start to gain some of these experiences and start to help them to understand that there is a whole nother part of our world that we're not seeing every day.
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a great resource and it covers such a wide variety of sea life, which is amazing. Like you just get this massive cross section. But with, so many to choose from, how did you decide what to include and what to cut?
It was very hard. I had to cut a lot of text. But yeah, like I said, I wanted to have this mix of animals that they would know and animals they didn't know. And I set myself challenges with introducing some new things. I was looking at the different families of animals, the different genera and all that, and I wanted to have a really good representation of all the different things. We know a lot about marine mammals. We know a lot about fish, but that's a fraction of what's out there. And you never know what's going to intrigue someone. What might be really interesting for someone is going to be very different. So I wanted to try to just open up this world and give a bit of a glimpse into how diverse it is. You cannot imagine, you can't even begin to imagine all the different things that are out there. But I just, tried to pick and choose, and I had a spreadsheet up of all the different, groups of animals that can be found in the marine world, and I was ticking them off. And I tried to tick off one at least in each of these groups, just to show a bit of the spread and the diversity. And yeah, like I said, just to try to get the kids hooked.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So, in doing your research and preparation for shark attacks and ocean animals, how were your approaches different in terms of the way that you handled, I guess, storyboarding and, just writing for the two different audiences?
Trial and error. When I wrote the shark attacks book, I had never written a book before, and in scientific publishing, in journal manuscripts and things like that, when I was taught to write these publications, one of the lessons or one of the things that my supervisor told me was, take for every two words, turn it into one. And so it's all about, short, very sharp messaging. There is no fluff. There's no time to tell a story. So it was really, trying to take that very scientific writing mindset and turn it into something that could be followed, could be engaging. And it did. It took lots of reviews. I had a fantastic team at CSIRO Publishing to work with, and they were very patient with me. I think you could really see from the comments and the feedback I was getting, you could really see where my scientific brain turned on. Like, for example, in the statistics chapter, which I wrote first, and the anatomy section, which I wrote quite far in the beginning, because those are the things I knew. And then some of the other chapters that I then had to push myself in, the writing was very different, because one of them turned on my scientific brain and the other one I hadn't focused on in that light before. So it was a bit more conversational, because I was almost trying to explain it to myself, because I don't have any training in psychology. So I had to really try to understand it. And in trying to explain it to myself and understand it, I was then explaining it to the audience as well. But I had to sort of merge the two so that it sounded and it looked like one person wrote the book, and so that it
Yes.
was easy to read and that it flowed and was consistent and all that. So it took a little bit of time, and same for the Ocean Animals book. I'd never written for kids before, and I was so heavily reliant on feedback from both CSIRO Publishing, and I also chose a few kids that I knew, and I was sending chapters out to them saying, "Do you understand this? Is it interesting? Did you like it?" And again, I was going out to these kids going, "Did you like my work?" And their opinion meant so much to me, and I was so nervous about how it was going to come back and how it would be received. But yeah, just trial and error and feedback and revising and learning.
Oh, amazing. Just such a great learning process.
It was fantastic. Both times I've submitted the final manuscripts, I've actually been really sad because I've just
Oh.
had so much fun working on these things, and I get very excited about them, if you can't tell.
Yeah.
And so having them kind of come to a close has been very bittersweet and something that I've been almost had to, I was going through a bit of withdrawal.
Oh no. Guess you have to write another book.
Yeah, we'll see.
On top of authoring, you're also shark editor at Australian Geographic, and we've already touched a bit on your consulting work for Sharks and Shark Attacks. But, you've also got your consulting business helping others with their own academic and scientific communication. I understand scientific communication in terms of education, but, what prompts you to help others with this kind of area?
Science communication, I find it really fun. I find it absolutely fascinating, and it sort of blends my interests. So it's something that I've sort of happened into almost, but I couldn't have picked a better field to get into, a better way to spend my time, really. Most of what I do, it none of it feels like work. So when I'm trying to help other people with their science communication, I get this amazing experience of being able to research a field that I've had no experience in most cases, understand it well enough to then be able to go back to them and help them to take what they've done, which is often very technical, often very scientific, and again, it's every two words has become one word. So helping them to then use that to tell a story, and whether they're writing a grant, which would then it's basically a story for the granting body, or if they're writing a project report, then it's a report for whoever's funded it. There's all these different audiences. So first understanding the audience, which is something that I have learned how to do through my work. You first have to identify your audience, and then you have to understand what they're looking for, what their background is, and why they're wanting to talk to you in the first place. And then being able to translate into those terms. So, for a granting body, obviously they're going to want a return on their investment. They're going to be in a specific field. They're going to want to be seeing benefits to different people. So, understanding all those things and then fitting the terms. So, I'm so fortunate to work with people who have amazing ideas. They're phenomenal scientists and so creative and just brilliant in what they're planning. So it's really easy to get excited about it. So it's then just taking that excitement and showing whatever audience it is why it's exciting for them. And yeah, it's like a puzzle, and I just love it. I get so interested in it, and I become so involved that sometimes I have to remind myself, wait, this isn't
This
my
isn't my
project.
project.
This is someone else's. But it's finding the excitement and finding the interest and how you can engage with people. And so it's just this resounding theme through everything I do. Understanding your audience, being able to engage with them, and then just conveying the excitement, because there is everything that's being worked on that I've been lucky enough to be a part of is so exciting. It's just, finding that thing that makes it exciting for all the different audiences.
Oh, yeah, just being able to help hype things up for everyone else, that's just such a good job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so we might start to move on to some of those other questions. So What hobby or interest do you have that's most unrelated to your field of work?
I became very interested in photographing insects. So
Ooh.
again, it's I don't know. Well, I guess I sort of do know how it happened. I like being outside, and with my kids, I was wanting them to be outside. And I'm also very scientifically minded. I love different animals, and insects have never been something that's really registered to me. But then, as I was trying to, well, I guess really it stemmed from their curiosity and their just, excitement around everything. Everything is new, everything is exciting. And they'd see an ant, and for me, an ant is just, we see them all the time, and they're either in my house or they're outside, but it's just part of life. But as you're raising very young kids and they're seeing these things for the first time, they're fascinated by an ant. And I sort of
Yeah.
think, I really wanted to get back to that passion for things that I just took as commonplace.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I did, I was trying to learn more about them. What kind of ant is that? Or, what kind of grasshopper is that? And so I started taking photos of them, and I started, getting closer and closer. I just use my phone, my iPhone most of the time, because I usually have it in my pocket. But as I was starting to do these things, I was getting some really awesome photos, and they're not going to win any awards, but it really helps you to see these things. And I'm all about diversity. I'm all about what makes things unique and why things have features that they have. And by just starting to look in my own backyard for things and then seeing them a bit closer to what I normally would, I just got so excited that I probably got a bit carried away. In fact, I think I almost turned my kids off of looking at bugs because they'd see something
Oh,
and then,
mom,
oh, mom's
again.
going to take a picture. And then I'd take a couple pictures and I'd want to get close and I'd want to get this angle. And yeah, they've left. And I can hear them going, oh, she's taking pictures again. So I've had to pull myself back a little bit. But yeah, it's become a bit of a hobby.
That's cool. So what else do you do with it? Just use it for, researching what sort of insect it is?
I don't do much with them. I just it's given me, I guess it's just given me a chance or a reason to look at things a bit closer. And I guess it's sort of similar to what I was saying about the ocean. I'm seeing this whole new world that I had just sort of been blinkered to before, because in my adult life, it was just, it was just walking.
They
I would
just
walk
are,
through
yeah.
something instead of just really taking the time to look around. And so,
Exactly.
yeah, if I'm really busy, I will, and I can see I'm working, 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 and I'm not having any breaks. I started almost building just 5 minutes into my day where I would go outside and try to find an insect that I hadn't seen before. And I still don't know what most of them are, but just taking that time to go outside and check my plants and see if I could find something that I hadn't seen before. And it gave me a reason to just have a bit of a breather and to go outside for a minute to stand up and, get the blood moving again. And
It's a
yeah, it's
great little
been
mini
really beneficial.
meditation.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, and which childhood book holds the strongest memories for you?
I'd have to say Winnie the Pooh. I was a
Ooh.
big Winnie the Pooh fan, and even probably longer than I should have been. But for some reason, I became, I don't know, it was a calming sense for me. And even when I knew the stories, I remember having a tape, like a cassette tape, because I'm old, and I would make this
Yeah,
cassette tape when I couldn't sleep at night, as I got a bit older, if I was having trouble sleeping, if I was thinking, worried about exams or whatever it might be. And I would just play this cassette of the stories, and I knew them so well that I wouldn't have to focus on them. But it was just something that was calming, and I knew it would just switch off when it got to the end of the side, so I wasn't didn't have to wake up and turn anything off. And so I feel like, I've just got these strong ties that in different parts of my childhood, I used the Winnie the Pooh stories in different ways, and I used to draw the characters out of them. And it was a way that I sort of engaged a bit with the arts. I wasn't much of an arts kid, but it sort of gave me a few reasons to dabble, I suppose. And
So what engaged you so much about Winnie the Pooh?
I have no idea. Yeah, I was thinking about this question and I can't remember the first time that I heard the stories. I know that, my mom used to read them to me every once in a while. But I can't remember when I first got into it or what my first experience was, but I do have these different sort of categorized memories of the stories in different ways, different parts of my life and how I use them in different aspects of my life. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. I think occasionally, like, there's always a book that it's inexplicable, but it kind of, it's like a safety blanket. You don't know what it
Yeah.
is. It's just a thing that's comfortable.
Yep, that's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Great. And lastly, what advice would you give someone who'd like to do what you do, and what advice should they ignore?
So advice as to what I would recommend is to just be open to things. Like I said, when I did my undergraduate degree, I was very displeased with the fact that I had to take all these different, core curriculum classes. I had to take English. I hated English when I was a kid. And I had to take organic chemistry, and I couldn't think of anything worse than getting up and going to my organic chemistry class. But a lot of the classes that I was forced to take, I either really got into at the time. So for science classes in particular, all the things that I didn't think I had any interest in, the more I learned about them and the more involved I became with them, the more fascinated I became with those subject areas. And then other things, like I was saying, I had to do English, and I'm so grateful now that I had to do English because I use it every day, and it's this foundation from having that training, that very high level training in undergraduate level English that I use. And if I didn't have that, I wouldn't be where I was now. So, try to think of things as an opportunity. Even if you don't want to do them, embrace them. You might not love it at the time, but you never know when it's going to come in handy. And you never know how you might end up using it 5, 10, 20 years down the track. So,
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
try to embrace it. And as well, if you're interested in something, the other thing that I would recommend to myself if I could go back, 20 years, is to think broadly. So, it's very easy if you're really passionate about something, it's easy to sort of pigeonhole yourself. But if you can follow your passion, but also take a bit of a broader scope to it, if you're doing your undergraduate or postgraduate studies in a field, that's when it's especially easy to pigeonhole yourself. But learn
Yes.
techniques that are very broadly applicable, because again, you don't know when you'll be able to use them, or if whatever, little niche that you're going down doesn't pan out, or you change your mind, you want to branch out. You've got a lot more options if you've learned, some of these broader, more applicable techniques that are very topical, even if you don't think that you're going to be using them then. So, yeah, to try to stay a bit broad and to always think outside the box. You never know what's going to come up or what might be beneficial to you. Don't think that there's only one way to do something. Look for the new ways to do things. Be innovative, be creative, and don't sell crazy ideas short. You just never know what's going to be the winner.
Exactly. Yeah. Just keeping your options open and just being able to think about all of these other potential ideas that could come from whatever it is that you're doing
Yeah, exactly. You never know. You never know what the future is going to hold.
now.
Yeah, just prepare yourself and be open to things, and yeah, find those little insects that excite you, and
Yeah.
stop. Yeah, think about how children see the world, and it's been one of those great little lessons that I've learned. Find the excitement in everything.
Oh, yes, definitely. You need to keep that wonder.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I love about the ocean. There's so much that we don't know. It's so easy to just have this sense of wonder, sense of curiosity, and just sense of awe at everything, because it's an amazing part of our planet that we just know so little, so there's so much opportunity.
Yes, definitely. And be, yeah, with again. As you described, all the new technology coming out, helping us to, get all of this extra information to be able to learn all these new things about the things that, we're just scratching the surface of. It's fantastic.
Yeah. the things that we're going to learn that we never knew that we didn't know
Yes.
in the next 5, 10, 50 years. It's, I can't wait. I'm so excited to see what
Yes,
comes out
very
next.
much. Yeah, just, yeah, sky's the limit for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you so much for speaking to me today, Blake. It's been absolutely wonderful and just really inspiring listening to you speak about how excited you are about all of this and, you know, learning about sharks. I crash course a bit last night, but my goodness, like so much scope and so much stuff around all of this. And, you know, I love psychology. So the fact that all of this is kind of focusing on the psychology on both sides is just mind-blowing to me. It's great. So if people would love to learn more about what you do and the kind of work that you do, where can they do that?
I've got a website that talks about the different things that I do. So it's blakechapmancoms.com. You can usually just Google me and somewhere along the list I'll come up. Yeah, that's probably the best way. I am on social media, although not as much as I should be, I'm afraid. Yeah, the website is probably the best.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so thank you again so much for this. It's been wonderful speaking to you today. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing all the other stuff that you're working on, maybe next book. But yeah, just loved reading your book so far. I haven't finished it yet. I've kind of just skimmed the chapter so far, but oh, so interesting.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, anytime someone says that they've gotten something out of it, that's why you do it. And yeah, I love hearing stuff like that. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Okay, well, thank you again and have an amazing day.
Thank you. You too.
It's difficult to not be enthused about sharks after speaking with Blake, and it's such a great perspective to consider the psychology of shark and shark attack from both shark and human perspectives. There's so much we still have to learn about sharks and their role in our global ecosystem. So it's been wonderful to learn about how new technologies have been deployed, not only to help mitigate the risk of shark attack, but also provide more avenues to research the behaviours of our marine life. To learn more about Blake and what we discuss in the show, or to connect with us, please visit the Steam Powered website at steampoweredshow.com. You can also find out more about Blake's work on her website at blakechapmancoms.com and social media, the links for which will be in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to hear more like it, subscribe to this podcast and share this with your geeky or geek curious friends. You can also support Steam Powered on Patreon and Ko-fi under Steam Powered Show, the links for which will also be in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.